I'm actually a bit happy about the panel discussion today because I think that some of the topics that were discussed there, I'm scratching at least a bit. Complexity, say, of quantum systems, in particular in two dimensions. And before I start, I would like to welcome every question at any point. Like, let me emphasize that. I have some slides prepared, of course, but actually, while I was giving the talk the last two times, I made it to the first half because of some extended discussions which were emerging, and I wouldn't mind at all if this would be the case again today. And mainly, the main topic somewhat of what I would like to present to you is that I somewhat think that now, within the last few years, these neural quantum states that we have been hearing already during this conference more than once might be maybe the tool in the future to go if you want to study two-dimensional quantum many-body systems, so both concerning ground states and dynamics. And the two people you see here, on the one hand, Ao Chen, who is a PhD student in my group, I will present some results of that he obtained concerning ground states. And on the dynamics side, when I make it to that point, Markus Schmidt is really the key person who pushed all that. And now I recognize that actually he's not in Jülich anymore, but now at the University of Regensburg, also in Germany. Good. So, what is the quantum many-body problem? Like you all know, we have a Hamiltonian, and solving the quantum many-body problem, you can typically go in two ways. Either you can try to go for the static Schrödinger equation, getting its eigenstates or just the ground state, or you go the dynamic way and try to solve the full time-dependent Schrödinger equation. And I would like to show you in the following two cases, examples for two such cases, either on the ground state problem or on the dynamical problem, where I think that the neural quantum states by now are quite successful. Now, what is the problem? Why should we think about yet another method to solve the quantum many-body problem? So we have already quite a few. And the problem is that, in general, the quantum many-body problem is difficult, and in particular, it's difficult in two spatial dimensions. In one dimension, the situation is quite different. I think tensor networks, matrix product states are super successful. So there's a lot has been done in that along that line. But in two dimensions, the situation is quite difficult, different. And now when I talk about difficulty, of course, or complexity, that's with respect to what? And in the end, it means the complexity is always a matter of the method, I would say. And we have methods that in some regimes work well, but which are facing some difficulties in some regimes. So of course, exact diagonalization, although quite primitive in some way, is super useful in many contexts. But of course, especially when you go to high dimensions, it suffers from the curse of dimensionality. The growth of Hilbert space is just unmanageable somehow. Of course, we also have tensor networks, which are matrix product states, which are super successful in one dimension. But in two dimensions, they also face their issues, either in terms of entanglement growth or in terms of, say, matrix contraction complexity. And of course, there's the good old Monte Carlo, which works certainly amazingly well for many problems, but also there are classes of systems which cannot be solved using Monte Carlo, namely those where the infamous sign problem enters. And in the end, these neural quantum states are just yet another class of, in the end, describes a kind of algorithm to solve the quantum many-body problem. I guess that many of you know this already, so I'll be quite quick here. So what is this class of variational wave functions doing? So say you have a quantum state, psi, of some many-body system. You can always express it in some basis. So here we will choose some generic computational basis, say of spin 1/2, so which would mean that these are all the spin configurations of the system. In the end, all the information of your quantum state is then contained in these amplitudes. And the way these neural networks try to approach the problem is that they are in some way storing these amplitudes in a neural network in the following way, or somewhat they are encoded in a neural network. So in a simple feedforward description, what you do is you have some input layer where you input your spin configuration. Here it's sigma, here it's S, but you should identify this. Should be identical. So you input your spin configuration, you process this information somehow. In the end, you get an output, and that output is exactly this amplitude psi of S. So what you gain here is you don't have to store your amplitudes. You can generate them on the fly when you need them. When I mean generate on the fly, when I mean them, in the end, all of that boils down to some kind of variation Monte Carlo technique. We have heard about that. So in the end, what we will do, we will just sample in the end certain spin configurations. So we will sample that neural network. And that way, we don't have to store the amplitudes. We can just generate them when we need them. And there is one important aspect, which is this is, in the end, a numerically exact procedure, like in the following sense that due to the universal function approximation theorem, we know that the kinds of networks that we will consider can approximate any function to an arbitrary accuracy. So they can also approximate psi of S, which is also just a function. Provided you can make your neural network large enough. So in some way, in that sense, you have a convergence parameter here, which is the size of the neural network. And you just know that you always have to converge to the exact solution when you increase the size of the network. Okay? In that sense, it's a numerically exact procedure. Good. So let's go to some actual examples. And here I really have to point out in the beginning, what I will now tell you is really mostly due to Ao Chen. You should keep an eye on him. He's a first year PhD student. He had the idea to what I will show you in the following. As his first PhD project, I was proposing something different. But I think it's really amazing what he, in the end, achieved. And he's still in his first year, like, let me emphasize that. So, and the credit really goes to him. Now, in the end, again, some quick summary. So the neural quantum state, in the end, is a variational wave function. Because the amplitudes, in the end, that our neural network gives us, of course, depend on the parameters of our neural network, so on the weights and biases that we have. And now, if we are interested in the ground state, we can do the standard minimization of the variational energy of our variational wave function ansatz. And now here comes a bit one point. Now, how do you do this optimization? And it was mentioned by Miles in this panel discussion. Of course, on the one hand, you have the expressivity maybe of a certain kind of variational wave function, but there's the second leg, as he said, like the second leg is the optimization. And actually what I would like to discuss with you in the following is the second leg corresponding to this set of variational wave functions. So this one standard way of actually minimizing that energy is stochastic reconfiguration, which I will abbreviate in the following as R, which you can just think of implementing effectively something like an imaginary time evolution. And imaginary time evolution, of course, directs you always towards the ground state in the end. And though you're not doing actual imaginary time evolution, what you actually do is you You do a time evolution, a kind of time evolution in your space of variational parameters that you have, and the final equation that you have to solve is this innocently looking one. So theta dot, in the end, is a vector of derivatives of your variation parameters. So that tells you how you should update your variation parameters during optimization. And S is a matrix, and F is also a vector. So the only thing you need to do, you need to invert that matrix S. That's the whole thing you need to do. And when you're able to do that, inverting this matrix, you only have a set of nonlinear coupled differential equations. That's where you have to go. That's it. But now comes an issue, and that issue is associated also to the one aspect I was highlighting before. And the aspect I was highlighting before is that in principle this is a numerically exact method, but it's only numerically exact if you can show convergence. So meaning that you can increase the network size actually and get all of that converged. And here comes actually an issue. So this vector theta here, of course, is a vector. So that's contains all the variation parameters. And that, as a consequence, also has the consequence that this matrix S is a matrix of the size number of variation parameters times number of variation parameters. So now the inversion that you have to do here comes at a cost, and the cost is in general that the inversion of a matrix has a computational complexity of size of the matrix, linear size of the matrix to the power 3. And actually, it's this numerical cost which currently limits the possibility to go to large number of variation parameters. Of course, there are also iterative methods for inverting matrices, which bring down this cost of np to the power 3 to just linearly np, but you have to pay a price. And the price is that you have to do a lot of iterations, and that costs you a lot of runtime in the end. So the gain in the end is almost minimal, finally. And what I would like to do, and that's this idea of Ao Chen, is that instead of going for a iterative solver, you can actually solve this equation in a computational complexity which is only linear in the number of parameters, while keeping the accuracy of stochastic reconfiguration exactly the same. So in other words, you can solve this equation here and this inversion actually just linearly without any iteration, okay? And of course, that allows you to go to much, much larger number of variation parameters. Clear so far? More questions? Good. And the idea is super simple, embarrassingly simple. So actually, when you study this matrix S that you want to invert, I was mentioning before that there's actually a Monte Carlo sampling procedure behind that, right? So we are always sampling configurations. And when you're working with a finite number of samples, in the end, you can easily recognize, when you look at the formulas currently here, you just have to believe me, that you can write this matrix as a product of two other matrices, naturally. So that just comes out by, you don't have to do any calculations to do that, that's supernatural. As a product of two matrices, where this matrix O dagger here has a size of number of variation parameters times number of samples. And here you have again number of samples times number of variation parameters. Now, when you recognize that, and if you are in a regime where you are You want to have a deep network with a large number of relational parameters, but actually, that's also typical in machine learning, you actually only have a small number of samples actually that you take in optimization. That it's actually super unfavorable to trying to diagonalize this matrix, because actually a matrix T that you can construct, which is the same one as S, but just like taking the other product, this matrix has exactly the same information as S. Yeah? And you can make this, so like that's a pictorial representation, but actually you can make this mathematically exact. So when you invert this matrix, so you can show that in the end, you can, this is fully equivalent to just inverting this matrix T. Huh? So there's no trick, it's an exact equivalence. But what you gain is you don't have to invert a matrix which is of the size number of relation parameters times number of relation parameters, but it's just number of samples times number of samples. Yes?
Is it equivalent to just doing an SVD of O?
No, so like there is a kind of SVD indicated here. So like if you were to do an SVD of O, it's somewhat clear that...
Sorry, O bar.
Yeah. SVD of O bar, yes, that should, yeah, that should be somewhat equivalent to that, yes. Yeah, exactly, yes, yes. Good, so like that's the actual idea, and now let me just show you how this works for a few concrete examples, and I'm focusing here just on the usual work, one of the workhorses and paradigmatic models, which we use for benchmarking these codes. And this is the antiferromagnetic Heisenberg model in two dimensions, and which with both nearest neighbors and next nearest neighbors. So if you set J2 equal to zero, you have the usual nearest neighbor antiferromagnetic Heisenberg model, which is still solvable using usual Monte Carlo. But if you add this J2 at a significant strength, this of course induces frustration, and this model becomes super challenging to solve. Now, let me first show you what one can do for the still easy case of the non-frustrated one, where we only have nearest neighbor Heisenberg model. And so what you see here is for a still relatively small system of 10 by 10 lattice sites, the error, relative error in the energy on a logarithmic scale as a function of the number of relational parameters. So there's a quite a few different data included here. On the one hand, there is the best result used that we could find on tensor networks. This is the dashed line here. There are some previous data, like using RBMs or shallow CNNs or some RBM with Lanchas. And the green data is the data that Ao Chen has been generating, and you can see in the end, like here, it's still like just for a bit more than 100,000 variation parameters. Now he actually has data, and the next version you will see for 1,000,000 variation parameters, and relative error on the level of 10^-7. So that means that, and I think that's why this is important, although it's still a relatively simple model, that we actually can get to machine precision. So to some extent, this is just a demonstration. It just means, yes, we can get this converged to an arbitrary accuracy if we wish. And by the way, it's also actually the best energy for the Heisenberg model, that although it's not a super hard problem, actually here you see a relative error in energy. Actually, we had to compute ourselves the actual ground state energy with SSE Monte Carlo to more digits than was available on the market so far. Yeah? So it's more like a demonstration. You can get the same accuracy also using conventional SSE expansion for with Monte Carlo, but this, the take-home message is you can get to numerical precision. And of course, the natural, and let me emphasize, if you want to know more, I can tell you that also, can also show you a slide later on. This is super efficient. So like there's no cluster needed for that. This is a few graphics cards. Yeah? Like this is a super easy calculation in the end. You take a few graphics cards and you get the best energy of the Heisenberg model in two dimensions. No supercomputer needed, not at all. And this runs for a few days and you're done. Good, and of course, we also wanted to go for the for a really complicated model, and the natural choice somewhat is the J1, J2 with frustration at the at a standard point, a frustrated point where the ratio of these two couplings is 1/2. And again, so on the left-hand side, you can see 10 by 10. You, again, quite a few reference points are included. Note that now we don't have an exact reference anymore, so we show just the bare energies. So there's no logarithmic scale anymore, but just a linear scale for the energy per lattice side here on the y-axis. But still the number of parameters as on a logarithmic one. On the left is 10 by 10, and on the right-hand side it's 16 by 16. So tensor networks, the best result we could find is up here. Although I also have to emphasize, of course, what we can only compare here is finite system size with periodic boundary conditions. So there are certainly also other results like with IPEPs, but we are just doing a having a hard time comparing that over with open boundary conditions. So that's the only, just to clarify. Then there's other data from, again, from different works before, like shallow CNN, there's an RBM and a CNN transfer. And there's also another work included PP plus RBM. And this is, a kind of variational wave function with some additional physical input in the end, and which is, has so far been the best, provided the best energies for the J1, J2 model in the end. Now for the 10 by 10 system, when going to like 100,000 variation parameters, you see that we somewhat reach that line of the best result. We are not better yet for 10 by 10. But when you go to 16 by 16 lattice sites already, one can see like that with this minus R method, you can get the best energy of the J1, J2 model. Now, how you can see it, of course, you have to look at the first digit where the numbers start to differ. So the first three digits are all the same, 0 minus 0.496. And then you have to look at the last digit, and you can see that the minus R, at least on an accuracy of 10 to the minus 4, is better than all the other methods. Yeah. So take home message here. So we can also solve challenging models like of frustrated quantum magnets. And at least for the J1, J2 model on a 16 by 16 lattice, you get the best variational energy, that best energy which is out there on the market. Again, just a few GPUs that you need to use. Yeah? It's not super expensive. Okay? Yeah, please. Yes, that's certainly also an aspect and a good question like that you can see here. So there's also, of course, an aspect of the network that our chain was using, which was performing extremely well, which has this super good slope upon increasing the number of variation parameters. If you were to take the RBM and do minus R, like you would end up here. So there's a second part of the story, which is that there's there are now also like super powerful deep networks that you can now use to train, and deep networks by themselves are more expressive, so you can get even even better performance. Yeah, so like these are two. Exactly, it's just because of the deepness of the network we can capture the sign structure so well. Yeah, that's the point. Yeah, so yeah, please. It's a kind of more or less standard CNN, but it's 64 layers deep. Yeah, so it's super deep. Like here, it's on this version of the paper, it's 100,000 parameters, but like in the latest data, 1 million parameters you can also train. So these are super deep net, relatively for physics standards, these are super deep. Yeah. Yeah, but here we are actually aiming not tailoring it specifically to the problem. We were actually more interested in general purpose approaches. So we were not tailoring the network towards a particular, towards any, like, of course we were somewhat incorporating some symmetries, that's correct. And it's some notion of locality because it's a CNN and also translation invariance, but not more input than that.
Okay, thanks. So I'm just curious, like for this metric method, like is it like specific to the quantum neuron state or is like a generalized mathematical method to like simplify the metrics?
So it's a different way of solving stochastic reconfiguration. So whenever you use stochastic reconfiguration, you can use that, potentially.
How many samples?
So there's, yeah, like I can amplify a comment like by Yannis that actually, like that's something we recognized and a bit later, there is actually also like many of this, we are not inventing actually something really new. So like this, there's something equivalent known already in the machine learning community, which is called the neural tangent kernel. Yeah. So in that sense, it's not new. Like, although we only got to know of this afterwards, but this, there is some, like this is known to some extent to exist also in the machine learning literature. Although there it's not used so much because stochastic reconfiguration is not often not the method of choice for optimization, whereas for physics it is.
How did you perform sampling? Like which sampler do you use and how many samples did you use?
Not many, a few thousand samples. Just using
droplets or?
Yeah, just a few thousand samples. Actually, that was my main initial concern when Ao Chen proposed this, because of course this only makes sense if the number of samples is much smaller than the number of ration parameters. If you want to have an accuracy of 10 to the minus 7, how can you get this one with 1,000 samples? One might wonder. And it took us a while to understand that this is actually possible. And the reason is that, of course, if you estimate some observable using Monte Carlo, the error goes as 1/√ of the number of samples. Yeah. But there's some second aspect, which one often overlooks. It's also proportional to the width of the distribution from which you sample. And when you're close to an eigenstate, to the ground state, this width is super small. So in some sense, increasing the number of variation parameters, meaning you can get closer to the actual ground state, meaning the variance of this distribution becomes smaller, you can actually decrease the number of samples in training.
Could I, in principle, turn this around and use this for quote-unquote normal AI and train my enormous transformer with natural gradient descent?
Yeah, like machine learning, they do have tried it, but I guess the difference is that we are really concerned here with accuracies in physics. We want to be exact. And actually, in many machine learning tasks, the it's not the main goal to find the absolute minimum of your variation manifold. You're often perfectly fine with some good local minimum, and then other solvers are equally qualified for that, which anyway have a better scaling behavior than like the stochastic reconfiguration. Further questions? Yeah.
For the 2D problems, just space like molecules, billions of RAM.
Yeah.
Approximative effect and so on. So I'm just wondering, like, did you ever compare this to something? Was that your first go to try to?
No, we honestly, we try. So I have a backup slide where we compared like different ways of inverting the matrix S and comparing performance runtime and like this we did, but we didn't compare to KFAK. No, so I cannot comment on that. If there are no further questions, then I'm actually done with my first part, so let me, how many minutes do I still have? No, I'm almost done.
We right? started a few minutes late, if you have 5 minutes.
Okay, okay. And which is the second thing which we have been actually working on mostly before, so not so much ground states, but trying to use these neural quantum states for dynamics. And so here I think the situation is even clearer than in concerning ground states, because when it comes to dynamics in two dimensions, there's not much one can do or there's not a large machinery of methods available otherwise that one can use to study dynamics. Tensor networks, MPS partly are able to do something, but still like that's a regime of quantum of the quantum problem, which is where our machinery is probably the least developed. And that's why we were going with the neural quantum states for that, because we were thinking, if we can get something to run, we are better than anyone else, because there's no anyone else in the end. But I think now, still, of course, there you, like tensor networks are have also like regimes of applicability. And I think in terms of limited time, I will now just flash a few examples what we have been doing in the last few years in this context. The first thing quickly to mention is when you want to solve quantum dynamics, you're essentially solving something almost identical to the stochastic reconfiguration problem. You now just do real-time dynamics instead of imaginary time dynamics, and the only thing which changes is that you have a factor of I here, a complex number, yeah, in your a differential equation that you want to solve. That's it. But it turns out that the solution of this equation, as innocent as the change is with this I here, becomes significantly more challenging. And the first few years was just like a lot of frustration along this line, because this is really a very difficult problem. Now, one quick flash here. So one thing that we were addressing, for instance, using these neural quantum states was the quantum Kirby-Zurich mechanism in two spatial dimensions. And one might wonder, like this should be settled. Quantum Kirby-Zurich is an old thing. But actually, this is not true. Actually, only in one spatial dimension, strictly speaking. And there's something super important in two dimensions, which is that if we believe in this correspondence that each quantum critical point corresponds to a conformal field theory, like this general correspondence, not proven but expected, there's a fundamental difference between 1 and 2D. Namely, that in 2D, conformal field theories are generally interacting. So there's no notion of a mode or a quasi-particle that you have. And actually, the quantum Kirby-Zurich arguments, they always are based on the notion of some modes that are getting excited. And on a fundamental level, in two dimensions, that picture breaks down, which in the end leaves open the question whether the quantum Kibbe-Zurek mechanism is actually at work also in 2D. Now it is, one needed to show that, first of all. It was not obvious at all, let's put it that way. So what we calculated using these neural quantum states for systems up to 20 by 20 lattice sites, so you do a parameter sweep in your system and you measure in the end the excess energy, and the Kibbe-Zurek mechanism predicts that this excess energy should be a universal function of some emergent correlation length, psi hat. And what we could show using these red data points that, going up to these large system sizes of 20 by 20 for the transfer speed Ising model, that we find some evidence of this universal behavior and that the excess energy had a power law dependence on this emergent correlation length in the end. And another aspect I want to highlight, which is where these neural quantum states can be also super useful when thinking about current experiments in quantum simulators, which is that since we are always sampling configurations, actually, and that's like as in Monte Carlo, as it has been done in all these quantum phase recognition problems, that we get snapshots of systems. But now we can also generate snapshots of systems as a function of time, and we can compare the actual experimental output, which are these snapshots, to theoretical predictions of these outputs. And in this context, we have been recently, so like that this has been put on the archive in the beginning of that year, done mostly by the postdoc Thiago Mendes Santos in my group, developing a way to compare data sets of snapshots. So in the end, the output of your experiment are snapshots. Your theory output is also snapshots. The problem is these snapshots are all different. They just come from the same distribution. Hopefully, if the experiment is doing what the theory is supposed to predict. So how do you compare just samples of distributions if you cannot reconstruct the distribution itself? And we were developing something which we called quantum wave function networks, with which we are networks of data sets or networks of snapshots, with which we have then tried to verify the output of a Rydberg atom array quantum simulator from the Antoine Brouvet group to theory predictions, which is much more than just comparing expectation values of observables. We were trying really to compare the full wave function snapshot data sets. I will not be able to go in detail through that, but in the end, this allowed us to, for instance, quantify an unknown error that they had in an experiment, some time shifts that were somewhat mysterious, and taking into account the time shift, we were able to show that up to some time, the theory and the experimental data were lying almost on top of each other. So like the up to some time, we could verify that the quantum simulator is really giving the correct snapshot output in the end. Good, and with this, I'm done. Thanks a lot, and if you have further questions, please go ahead.
Thank you, Markus. There were many questions already, but there's time for a few more.
All questions answered.
No, yeah, there's... Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for the great talk. One question I had was that if you maybe want to solve time-dependent problems now with this MinSR algorithm, you potentially might run into the problem of needing many samples to solve the equation accurately, right? As not to accumulate error. Yes. Is this something you have thought about, or?
Yes, but we quickly came to the conclusion that we should not use the MinusR for this dynamic problem, because actually there's a fundamental difference in the way you have to solve the dynamic problem or the imaginary time problem, in that you have to be much more accurate for each time step that you solve. So it means you have to take many more samples per each time step. And actually, typically, the expressive power of the neural network is not the limiting factor. In almost everything that we do, we would like to be there, but this is the limiting factor. So for ground state, it is the limiting factor, more or less now, I would say. Just the expressivity of the network. That was essentially the statement of the first part, I think. Here, the situation is fundamentally different. It's not the expressivity of the network. It's being able to solve this time-dependent variation principle. And there, the number of samples is much more important than the number of variation parameters in the end.
OK, thank you.
Last chance. Otherwise, for the questions that may come up, you can find Marcus at the barbecue, I think.
Yeah, sure.
All right, let's thank Marcus again.